States against McMillan.
Good morning, Your Honor, Counsel, and may it please the Court. My name is Parag Bayani, and I'm representing Defendant Appellant Harry William McMillan. Mr. McMillan challenges his conviction on two grounds. First, the evidence was insufficient as a matter of law to sustain the conviction under 2422B. The second is that the conviction rested on the back of improper propensity evidence that was admitted in violation of Rule 404B. I'd like to start with the sufficiency issue. The evidence was insufficient as a matter of law because Mr. McMillan's conduct did not fall within the ambit of 2422B. Now, 2422B is a narrowly drawn statute which proscribes a very narrow type of conduct. That is, a defendant who uses the Internet as the means of communication in order to persuade a minor. Now,
But you do agree that no other circuit has followed the legal approach that you're advocating, that using the Internet to try to entice the minor through a third party is a theory that quite a few of our sister circuits have endorsed.
That's correct, Your Honor. Other circuits have endorsed a situation where the defendant communicates with an adult intermediary, usually a parent of a minor, in order for the communication to take place.
We have evidence, whether that's the right theory, you can certainly debate, but if it is enough to use an intermediary, often a parent, it seems to me there's evidence in this record that Mr. McMillan did that. He suggests in an email maybe she'd like to see certain pictures, you know, kind of is she going to be enticed by whatever these pictures show? Any chance you can let me talk to your daughter directly? Have you talked to her about this yet? So there are these statements in the record that suggest that Mr. McMillan is doing precisely that. He's talking to this person who he thinks is the father, seeing if the father will persuade her. It doesn't seem to be a situation where we're in the coercion branch of this statute, but we're in the persuasion stance. I don't know how else to read those statements I just mentioned.
Your Honor, this is an attempt crime, and the elements of attempt are the intent to use the Internet to carry out the actual
right.
act of
and
persuasion.
Right, and so he's suggesting things to the father that might entice her to engage in the forbidden behavior.
I'd respectfully disagree, Your Honor. I would characterize those statements as approaches which are not necessarily directed towards communicating persuasive intent. Those statements do not necessarily, beyond a reasonable doubt, demonstrate that Mr. McMillan had the requisite specific intent to carry out an act of persuasion online.
Well, why couldn't a jury see that, you know, maybe she'd like to see a picture comment? What else is that other than enticing? I mean, I'm putting to one side whether it's really enticing, actually, but what else could it be for?
Well, it is possible, Your Honor, that specific statement could be taken as manifesting a specific intent to use the Internet to persuade. But moreover,
And if that's true, and if your theory about intermediaries is wrong, then we affirm this conviction.
I would disagree, right? Your Honor, because there's still no evidence that Mr. McMillan took a substantial step towards actually carrying out an act of persuasion. Now, that statement you referred to, which she'd like to see a picture of my would manifest an intent to persuade, but then Mr. McMillan would need to carry out a substantial step in order to persuade, and that could be, for example, sending the actual persuasive communication, whether or not they ended up reaching the minor. But Mr.
McMillan, the statute says using a facility of interstate commerce knowingly persuades, induces, entices, and or attempts to do that, and so that statement looks to me like it certainly uses the Internet and it's an attempt to entice. Whether she's ultimately enticed isn't important in the attempt statute. He's done the thing. He's sent the alluring statement along, so he thinks alluring.
I disagree, Your Honor. I still believe that that does not suffice to show beyond a reasonable doubt that Mr. McMillan took a substantial step towards carrying out an act of persuasion.
I don't understand what you mean by that, because this isn't the situation that we've faced in other cases where, you know, people are actually trying to set up physical meetings, and we look to see, you know, did they buy the train ticket, or did they book the hotel, or did they do these other things. Those cases do try to draw a line between just internet talk and actually taking a substantial step for the meeting. But once you've sent the email, isn't that the step of enticing?
Correct, Your Honor, but that email was not intended to be shown to Mike's daughter. That, therefore, the substantial step towards persuading the actual daughter was not fulfilled. Whether or not Mr. McMillan took a step towards meeting up with the daughter for the purposes of having sex is not relevant to the interview.
No, I know. That's a different thing.
And so this court should adopt an approach whereby the presence of an intermediary should not necessarily lead to 2422B liability. The plain language of the statute and the legislative purpose support such a finding, though other circuits have diverged from the faithful analysis of the spirit of the letter and the spirit of the law. I'll touch on them briefly. The plain language of the statute has four transitive verbs, four action verbs that imply some sort of objective by the actor to influence the target, persuade, induce, entice, or coerce. They do not say contact or get in touch with, and so the actual intent has to be shown to actually persuade. And furthermore, the legislative history, Congress in 1998, when they amended the statute, stated that they wanted to protect children from predators who would use the Internet as a means of reaching into the home and affecting or changing the will of vulnerable or innocent children.
So what about the argument the government makes that under your theory, where intermediaries are implicitly excluded from this statute, it leaves unprotected any children young enough not to be on the Internet? I'm not sure what age that is, by the way, anymore. I mean, it's two-year-olds, but it's... But there is some set of children who are actually much less likely to be on the Internet, and they're just, in your view, not covered by this statute?
That's correct, Your Honor. First of all, the legislative purpose said that they're protecting children who go online and are vulnerable to persuasion by predators online. The second is that
but
argument...
But that's not, of course, this gets back to our first argument. That's not what the statute says. The statute just says if using the facilities of interstate commerce, you knowingly persuade, induce, entice, or coerce, that's it.
That's correct, Your Honor. But if the minor is not online, is not receiving the communications, he or she cannot be persuaded.
Suppose the person sends an email. This is a hypothetical. Sends an email directly to the minor that says, you know, I'm really, you know, a great guy, and I want you to get in touch. You know, he gives references basically. You know, get in touch with your friend. Who I've also had encounters with, and your friend will endorse what a terrific person I am. So using an intermediary, suggesting the use of an intermediary in that way, is that enough?
That
a friend sends an email.
Well, in that case, Your Honor, it's that intermediary, the person, the referral, the friend to whom the initial victim was referred, who would be carrying out the act of persuasion. And so that person could be liable under the statute as a principal actor.
But you don't think using references, you know, or of course in this case having your father say, hey, you know, this is really a good idea, isn't enough?
I believe that reading does not comport with the plain language and legislative history. Now, under your hypothetical, you know, there could be a conspiracy charge joined to indict that the instigator of that sequence of communications. That could also be charged as an aider and abettor if they provided material support to the intermediary. And so there are federal remedies available, even under 2422B, for that course of conduct. And moreover, that does not even contemplate the other federal statutes that are designed to protect children who are preyed on online.
But that was not as persuasive a part of your brief, because those other statutes really don't address this. I mean, they do address associated things, but they don't address this particular conduct.
They don't necessarily address this particular conduct, Your Honor, but they give the lie to the government's claim that Congress has made no real effort to protect children who are preyed on online by predators. And not only that, Your Honor, there are also plenty of state statutes which could be employed to prosecute both the instigator and the intermediary under your hypothesis. You know, what this approach under the current approach under 2422B does is allows all types of conduct that may or may not fall within the ambit of 2422B to be shoehorned into the statute. And
I look at this statute as something that's addressed to this set of people, you know, kind of middle school aged or maybe a little older, who are persuaded or enticed over the internet, and then they go off on their own and they meet the predator. There is a set of people who unfortunately do that, and so this statute seems to be looking at that. And if an adult intermediary or any intermediary, I don't even think I would limit that to an adult, but if a trusted intermediary is part of the persuasion or inducement process, I don't understand where the statute says that can't exist.
Your Honor, the statute very clearly states that whoever using the internet knowingly persuades, induces, entices, or coerces, that is, the principal actor has to be the one who actually carries out the act of persuasion targeted towards the minor.
But you say, but you are adding an extra element to that, not just carries out the act of persuasion, but does so directly, does so in a one-to-one exchange, you know, predator to victim, without putting somebody else in that loop.
That's correct, Your Honor. And Congress could have created a more expansive statute which would have protected, which would have encompassed conduct that you're describing. For example, in 1998, there was a 2422C proposed that was never adopted, which would have stated, quoting, using the internet knowingly contacts, and that encompasses a broader scope of communication, which could include communications directed from a principal actor through an intermediary or through a trusted advisor to the victim, and uses the internet for the purpose of engaging in any sexual activity. And again, that broadens the scope of the nexus between the internet communications and the persuasive act. And so Congress considered a more broad reading of the statute, a more broad expansion of liability for predators online, and they rejected an approach as being too overbroad and punishing conduct that would really fall into types of course,
we never know why Congress doesn't pass legislation, especially these days. I'm a bit mystified, you know, about why they do or don't pass all sorts of things, and lots of explanations can come to mind.
There is legislative history supporting that statement, Your Honor. I'd be happy to supplement the record.
No, you don't need to.
And I'm in my rebuttal time. So.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Counsel. Mr. Norwood.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. The issue is pretty clear. I think the defendant wants to rewrite the statute so that it reads, whoever knowingly uses a means of or facility of interstate commerce to directly communicate with a minor and knowingly, they're trying to add words to the statute that the communication has to be directly with the minor, and it's just not in the statute.
But would you agree, though, that we do need some clue in the exchange that the defendant, the predator, whatever you want to call the person, that the defendant is instructing this intermediary to persuade or entice or, you know, any of the statutory elements, that you can't just have a direct encounter with an intermediary that doesn't have one of those elements.
Absolutely, and I believe there's more than ample evidence in this case. I think you hit one of the examples where the defendant asked, does she want to see a picture of my penis? Now, I think common sense dictates the only reason that communication is written is so that this 15-year-old will be impressed, persuaded, enticed by this picture. And then go to engage in conduct. There's a lot more communications, though. There was, for example, the defendant was talking about meeting with the father and the daughter first in a bar and then going to their house. And the text is, and I tried to get this quote exact, I'm sure if she was hanging out with us and showing me more of her sexy pics, things would probably take off. So it's trying to get them together, have the girl show sexual pictures of herself, and then things will take off. That's an attempt to persuade that minor into having sexual activity. I think there are other ones. Again, he wants her to be present all the time at the movie theater, wants to bring her there so he can communicate directly with her to have sex, to show her genitalia, wants to email the daughter directly. For what purpose? I mean, the entire communication was for the purpose of trying to entice, induce, coerce. You say maybe not coerce, but entice, induce, persuade the minor to engage in sexual activity. That's what this case is all about, and it's an attempt case. Like as you said, your sister circuits have unanimously indicated in factual situations like this the statute applies. I can't add anything or any more wisdom than what they've already put down in their opinions. And I do think these cases always arise, or 90% of them seem to arise in the case of a sting where the police officer is involved. But there were cases involved where it was individuals truly trying to connect with parents. There are parents out there who will provide their children to others for sexual gratification. And there are some that are young. And if this statute is not there to protect these children, there is a giant loophole where you can communicate with any third person. It doesn't have to necessarily be a parent, as you said. What if they communicate with the friend of the girl and convince that friend to persuade this minor girl to have sex with her? I mean, it just opens up a huge area that is covered right now.
It does have a broadening effect on the statute. Certainly, if the core concern of Congress was these minors who are visiting chat rooms or who are otherwise engaged in Internet activity, that's one possible statute when the defendant comes into the chat room and tries to persuade the person to change, to escalate things, let's say, from Internet to real, and then there's this whole new world of all these intermediaries. The question is really how broad is this statute?
But Congress could have written the statute to say whoever communicates with a minor with the intent to do this with a minor, and there'd be no issue.
Mm-hmm.
If they wanted to narrow it simply to people, and then you're narrowing it simply to a core, a certain age of people who can use the Internet. Well, kids are getting more and more advanced. I don't know how young they are when they're getting into these rooms and communicating with others, but it would still eliminate infants up to presumably age 3, 4, 5 that could be used. And then the other example I use is what if a child is deaf and only communicates with their parents through sign language or a third person, or a child who doesn't speak English and you can't communicate with them. So,
Counsel, I think it might be a good idea for you to move on to the Kelly evidence.
The 404B, I think that this is a model case for when 404B evidence should be permitted. The defendant, in his opening...
That's what you think, but of course that's not the standard.
I understand this is not what I think, but
where,
I think...
Where did Judge Gilbert assess the probative versus prejudicial force of this evidence?
Your Honor, he didn't do a 403 analysis. I mean, it's not there. I'm not going to try to pretend that it is. I suppose I have two responses. One, the government moved pretrial for the purpose of having the defendant make his argument why this shouldn't be admitted and illuminate the issue for the district court judge. The defendant chose not to do it pretrial. And then when the trial came, and I always do this at trial, I tell the judge, I'm getting ready to introduce 404B evidence. They did nothing at that point. This court has upheld cases where the court has not done that 403 analysis.
You know, we have recently heard argument en banc in Gomez, which presents that question. And another question that's presented in Gomez concerns the appropriate instructions to the jury. The instruction to the jury in this case seems like a model of what district judges ought never do. It essentially recites the language of Rule 404B, and gives the jury no guidance whatsoever about what, if anything, this evidence can legitimately be used for.
And, Your Honor, again, it's my understanding that at the time this trial was conducted, the state of the law was that was the limiting instruction that was provided.
Certainly not. This court had for years been telling judges not to do that, and the district judge then did it. We have a new set of pattern jury instructions. The district judge's instruction in this case isn't remotely similar to the current pattern jury instructions. Is there anything good one can say about what's happened here?
I'm trying to think when this trial was conducted. I'm not sure if the new pattern instructions were out at the time this trial was. I just don't recall.
Whether it is either. The date on this case, this is a 2012 appeal, and of course the new pattern was released in 2012.
The case was indicted in 2010, and I thought it was tried in 2011, but I could be wrong with that, Your Honor. The bottom line is the government seems to be
October of 2011 from what's in the brief.
I have the day of the closing argument.
I'm less worried about whether the new pattern jury instruction was used than about the fact that this court for years has been telling district judges, don't give an instruction in the language of the rule. You have to make it concrete. And this just parroted the language of the rule and did nothing to make it concrete. Now, as I say, why should we say, oh, fine?
Well, Your Honor, all I'm saying, all I can argue is that at the time this was tried, that was the law. I believe the instruction
opinions for years saying don't do this was not the law?
No, Your Honor.
It's very difficult to keep saying something and have district judges keep ignoring it.
I appreciate that your concern,
be,
Your
could
Honor.
Could be one reason why Gomez went en banc. Perhaps we will be louder or more insistent.
I appreciate your concern, Your Honor, and I believe this court gives, I know this court is, as you said, given instruction. I think an en banc decision with clear language as to what a limiting instruction should be.
Since we can't form a limiting instruction for every case, we can only tell district judges how they need to go about it. That's part of the problem here. We've been saying for years, don't just parrot the language of Rule 404B. Be concrete about what the evidence is useful for here. And it's that kind of basic approach to how you do this that the district court paid no attention to.
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, I can't change what
Did
the district court just
this instruction?
The limiting instruction?
Yes.
No, Your Honor, I...
Where did the text of this instruction come from?
And, Your Honor, it is... I'm going to say I don't know because I wasn't in the judge's mind, obviously. I believe...
But neither side suggested it?
I believe, and I'm guessing, Your Honor, I believe the judge pulled the pattern instruction for other acts evidence and uses that as the limiting instruction. Because it seems to follow that language.
So you didn't ask for it, and did the other side object to the limiting instruction?
The other side didn't object, Your Honor.
I try to do it
in every case. I did telegraph to the court, I'm getting ready to introduce 404B evidence, so the court can issue a limiting instruction if it wants to, and it did in this case. The crux of it is, though...
They did object to the introduction of the evidence, but they did not object to the efficacy of the limiting instruction.
Well, Your Honor, I think that was one of the issues.
Are you contesting that they
I'm not sure if they objected to the evidence. When we had the pretrial hearing on the motion in limine regarding the 404B evidence, the judge asked the defendant, do you want to address it now, or do you want to address it before it's introduced at evidence? The defense said, well, wait until it's introduced at evidence.
That itself is a violation of the rule. Rule 404B2 says these decisions must be made before trial. The judge saying, oh, well, maybe I'll make it before trial, maybe I won't. I'm certainly not blaming you for that. You made the motion in limine, which is what Rule 404B says ought to happen.
He did what he needed to do.
I appreciate your concern. Appreciate your concern. But I do want to get to the actual text of the rule because I think this evidence was crucial with respect to the defendant's intent in this case. This isn't a 404B is so often in controversy in a drug case where the evidence, well, he dealt drugs before, so we did it on this occasion. In this particular case, the defendant, in opening statement, indicated he did not have the intent to persuade entice course.
Well, he says he's trying to
role
catch
play.
Somebody, role play.
And then his testimony was he was trying to confront a child molester. I didn't have this intent. The fact, and that, and I think I did a decent job in closing argument of explaining why that just wasn't true. But if his intent was, as he claims, just to be role-playing or to confront a child molester, the emails with Kelly refute that. They directly go to his credibility on the stand, and they directly refute his argument regarding his intent. So the purpose of this 404...
I got one more question. Why are we talking about Rule 404? Isn't this, since this is a sex case, isn't this within the scope of Rules 413, 414, and 415?
I'd have to reread those rules. I know, I'm thinking I looked at them, but there were for some reason why it did not apply.
I
would have done it because those rules automatically include the evidence.
Would have.
But there was a reason I didn't, and I can't remember why as I'm standing here, but I remember looking at those rules. I don't have my code book in front of me. And I'm not sure if it's the definition of what type of crime it is.
Well, you weren't trying to talk about the victim's sexual behavior,
no.
So that's Rule 412. I looked at
and
Rule 2.
I'll be glad
two.
To.
And it's not a similar crime in a sexual assault case. That's Rule 413. I looked at them before this argument as well because I had exactly the same question.
And I know I looked at them, and I did not think they applied. That's
and
why.
Child molestation. Yeah, maybe they...
But, again, the defendant's intent was the only thing at issue in this trial. I mean, he admitted sending the emails. He admitted using means of interstate commerce. That was the only issue, was his intent. And these emails went to refute his story, and they affected his credibility. And the government believes it was, regardless of what formula you may develop with respect to 404B, based on the text of the rule, the government believes this evidence is admissible and was properly admissible in this case. If Your Honors have any other questions, I'll be glad to answer them. Otherwise, I'll rest on my brief. Thank you, Your Honors.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Counsel. Anything further, Mr. Bayani?
Yes, Your Honor. Your Honor, I would like to start off by saying that trial counsel did preserve the objection that should have triggered Judge Gilbert's 403 analysis, but more than the procedural error in not conducting the balancing test, there was substantial unfair prejudice in Mr. McMillan because not just because the inflammatory language of the Kelly emails directed towards a putative minor, but because they caused an unfair propensity inference. They invited the jurors to look at the Kelly emails, look at the nature of them, the fact that some of them may have looked like that they were persuading a minor over the Internet, and they invited the jurors to basically substitute Mike's daughter in for Kelly.
Why don't they refute, though, Mr. McMillan's theory that he was out there trying to catch somebody who was abusing children? The jury could see and decide for itself whether that intent was correct or whether he, in fact, was trying to set up an assignation with the daughter of the supposed father.
Correct, Your Honor, but that goes back to the original point.
To me, that's one of the 404B. 404B, as we explained or as we were discussing in our in-bank in Gomez so recently, it excludes certain evidence which is relevant, which is past the 401 standard, from consideration. And it says there's a use you can't make of this evidence, but there are all sorts of other uses that are okay. And it seems to me this one is a use to show what was his real intent.
Well, that's correct if the question is, was his intent to go out and have sex with the minor? But that's not what the question of 2422B is. The question is, did he intend to use the Internet as the means of persuasion directed towards the minor?
And he denies that. He says, no, I had no such intent. I was trying, in effect, to be a law enforcement officer. And the Kelly evidence refutes his claim.
The Kelly evidence does so by creating a propensity inference. The jury sees there's no evidence in the record that shows that Mr. McMillan was trying.
It's not a propensity inference. It's an argument about intent, right? It's an argument about why one sent particular communications.
Even if he had never done it before. You know, propensity evidence tends to be you did it before, now you'll do it again. But this is something he's doing simultaneously, and what's his purpose? What's his intent in doing it?
Correct, Your Honor. But it also, the intent probative value, first of all, it's greatly diminished in comparison to other case law in this circuit, like excuse me, Siebold, Zahursky, and Chambers, where the defendant in those cases admitted to prior sexual acts with minors, that gave the lie to the claim that they were not intending to persuade online in the present situation. But in Mr. McMillan's case, he had not admitted to any such prior assignations. And so what – and I see I'm – may I finish the question?
You can certainly finish answering Judge McMillan.
And so what it was causing the jury to do was substitute in Mike's daughter for Kelly in the analysis of the emails.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bayani. And we thank you, and we thank Indiana University Law School for your willingness to accept the appointment in this case and your assistance to the court as well as your client. The case is taken under advisement.